We then cut to an extended scene full of uncomfortable looking sex on various hard surfaces in Crown's house.
Worst.
I just was like, how is this happening?
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dicer.
Soon you'll know everything about me.
There are things we don't know.
Like what?
Like why? Were you bored? Acquisitions and mergers looking a little stodgy. Was it more fun getting it than keeping it?
And is this the fun part for you?
How do you mean?
It's not about the money. You like the chase.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 111. Mm. 3-1. Tres Unos.
Tres Unos.
1-1.
Triple snake one, eyes. One. Yes, triple one, snake one. Eyes. Something like that. Yes, 1-1. 1-1.
1-1.
Today's big recommend is The Thomas Crown Affair from 1999. Sorry, Steve McQueen fans. I'm Chris Atkinson. I'm joined by Aaron Dicer.
Oh, hey there. Didn't see you.
And joined by Jeremy Scott.
Tres Unos.
That's right. Tres Unos. I can't wait to market that beer. That'll be amazing. All right. And also like to acknowledge the chat coming out here to watch us talk about movies on a Tuesday. Thank you so much for coming out. Does anybody have any small recommends?
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I'll go first. I have had a journey. Change of opinion on a film. It's The Last Duel from 2021.
Yes.
With Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and Adam Driver and Jodie Comer. Yeah. It is on Hulu right now if you would like to peruse this film. I am not entirely sure. I can't really put my finger on why, but when I saw this back in 2021, I did not have a great time. And I think a lot of it was that I was trying to cram award likely films in a small amount of time. And so I think I get tired mentally sometimes when I do that. And so I wrote it off as just a poor Rashomon imitation. And it's certainly a take on that kind of a thing. I saw this film again last week and really changed my opinion on it. Trigger warning, the whole film conflict revolves around a sexual assault, a rape. And I appreciate that the film does not make that scene graphic. What it does basically is it shows us these events in France in the 1400s from three different perspectives, Matt Damon's, Jodie Comer's, and Adam Driver's. Jodie Comer believes she was raped. Adam Driver believes it was consensual. Matt Damon believes his wife and calls for a duel. I think this movie has a lot to say about men and how we treat women and have historically treated women, but also how highly we value ourselves above all else. All three of the male leads, Affleck included, nobody looks good here. All of these people are terrible people, and I think that's by design. But also, the final duel between these two men is one of the most brutal battle-like sequences, and it goes on a lot longer than I was expecting. I was really impressed. This is a good reminder to me to go back to films that I didn't enjoy as much the first time, because for whatever reason, I may not have seen everything that I would see now. So Affleck and Damon wrote this film. Ridley Scott directed it. I just think, you know, nobody really talks about it. And I was one of those people until last week, and now I'm going to talk about it. So there you go.
Yeah, I love The Last Duel. And I can't believe this movie, that House of Gucci was the one that everybody wanted to give nominations to out of the Ridley Scott movies in 2021, and not this one. But this one didn't do anything. No, it didn't come. It was a tremendous bomb when it came out, and but everybody who's watched it since seems to really, really like it and everything. The only thing about this movie that I thought was weird was that I think Adam Driver's relay of the events is like doesn't make him look good whatsoever. It's if I recall, like it's if you're gonna do a Rashomon thing where I didn't do anything, well, his relay of the events basically says, yeah, I did it or whatever. It's kind of weird. So I don't know if that, I guess that was, I mean, I'm sure that's on purpose, but that was weird to me.
I think there's an arrogance to his version of the events. I think that's what it is like, yes, this is what happened. Now it's not the same as we eventually see from her perspective, but his version of events is to show like, I'm entitled. This is an entitlement thing. Like I'm, you know, entitled to this, you know, kind of thing. And it's what I loved most about the movie. Even aside from some really fun, great performances, you mentioned that the last duel, titular last duel is pretty amazing. But I love that this is not just Rashomon. It's Rashomon that says, you know, some perspectives should hold more weight than others. Mm. It has that thing where it's like, there is a right answer here kind of idea, you know, in what I'm showing you. And I found that really fascinating and interesting and thought provoking. So, yeah, it's good stuff. Mm-hmm. Speaking of thought provoking, I'll go next. My thoughts have been provoked by Civil War, Alex Garland's new movie, as my thoughts are often provoked by Mr. Garland. I have very much enjoyed most of his stuff. I've found worth and value in all of his stuff. Yes, even Men. But Devs, the TV show Devs, I thought was absolutely great. Ex Machina, everybody loves for good reasons. You know, it's phenomenal. Annihilation, I love that movie. This is maybe the most quote unquote accessible thing that he's ever done, in that it really is a pretty straightforward story of a world that is at war here in America. And it follows these journalists as they are trying to get the biggest story. Photojournalists, as they try to take these pictures to tell the truth about what's going on. One of the things I really enjoyed about this movie was it didn't feel to me that it was saying anything specific about our current, you know, polarized political, you know, state. Aside from that, this is the kind of thing that happens in those polarized states, but it wasn't saying like, oh, here is the, you know, the side that I side with. It was more saying, here is how you keep the truth available to history. And I found it really, really fascinating. I think Kirsten Dunst is phenomenal in this film. I love her so much. Lots of great performances. I'm going to be thinking about this one for a while. I can't wait to watch it again, and watch with a little more detailed eye, as opposed to just experiencing the journey, that first time through. So, yeah.
Yeah. This is going to be a second viewing for me before I really can nail down what I think about it, because my first viewing was like, I don't know if I like this too much. And then I loved like the second half of it and everything. I did love, Kirsten Dunst quite a bit. This is one of her career defining roles probably at this point, and then everybody's talking about basically a 5 to 10 minute Jesse Plemons scene.
It's basically a cameo.
And it's funny, is it possible he might get one of those like 5 minute Oscar nominations for his performance in
this? He's really good.
He's so good.
I just love that they met on Fargo and got married, and it seems like they're trying their damnedest to work together as often as they can. Like, I really, really like that.
Apparently the Jesse Plemons was a different actor, and he couldn't do it. And so Kirsten Dunst did go and say, hey, well, I know somebody,
but that's awesome.
But, it's funny. They have been in quite a bit, since then and everything, and the Power of the Dog and all that.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Mine is not as heady as you guys' are. Mine is a 1987 vampire movie called Near Dark, which was directed by Catherine Bigelow. This came out the same year as Lost Boys and a lot of other vampire movies and things of that nature. The funny thing about this one is the association Catherine Bigelow has with James Cameron is so apparent in this movie. Because Lance Henriksen is in this, Bill Paxton's in this, Jeanette Goldstein. But it's a very, very simple vampire flick. It's basically follows a guy who he sees this pretty young woman. He's following her around. He's kind of a dick. He kind of deserves the things that happens to him in this movie, by the way. And she is a vampire. She bites him, and she does it in the way that turns him. So now she's inviting him into what is a family of vampires led by Lance Henriksen. And they all tell him, you need to actually drink somebody's blood or you're not one of us. And so that's the one of the conflicts of the movie. And then he also has his real family that's looking for him during this. I really enjoy Near Dark. I don't know. It's one of those, I think a lot of people compare this to Lost Boys, like which one's better? Lost Boys is like more bonkers than this movie. So if you like Lost Boys, you know, over this, it's mainly because of, you know, how, I mean, there's no doubt Lost Boys is a little bit more fun than this movie is, I think. But I think Near Dark is like a better movie overall. So fun little vampire movie. If you guys ever want to go check it out, I saw it on Criterion, over the weekend. So, there you go. All right. On, to the, big recommend, which is Thomas Crown Affair. And we'll let Jeremy take it away.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Shit, I forgot to prepare. I'm just kidding. Boy, I love me some McTiernan. His films are not always perfect, but there's some quality to them that always entertains me. And this one is no different. We open on a therapy session where Thomas Crown is talking about women and trust and most of the themes that of the movie we're about to watch. It's also notably the darkest therapy room I've ever seen in my life. Very, very mood lighting. And his therapist is Faye Dunaway, who played the Rene Russo role in the original film. We then see Crown getting out of his car in traffic to walk to the museum. He almost gets smashed flat by a large truck, which I think is meant to show that Crown is not superhuman and is capable of being surprised. He then enters the Met, but let's stop here and make sure everybody knows this is not the actual Met, even though it is. They go out of their way at the end of the film in the credits to let you know, hey, this was not the Met. They're not saying it was the Met. The Met security is awesome. We're not shaming them. But it's the Met. I'm just going to call it the Met and alternatively the museum. He then enters the Met to look at his favorite painting of haystacks. It's implied that he is a regular. The museum, I don't know if he's a guard or whatever he is, but he knows him, talks to him, comes every day apparently to look at these haystacks. He also pulls a croissant out of his briefcase and eats it, which I think is kind of a no-no. I feel like if I was in a museum and I pulled out a croissant and started eating it, somebody would be like, hey, what are you doing? Anyway, we then see him arrive at his office. He owns the entire building. Dun, dun, dun. He's super wealthy. And his secretary mentions that he forgot his briefcase. He says he left it here last night, which we know is a lie because we saw him take that croissant out of it in the museum. We then also start cutting to some footage of a large item being delivered to the Met. It's a horse, but they were expecting a sarcophagus. What do we do with that? I do love how McTiernan intercuts like these heisty guys in the museum with Crown's business dealings and kind of heisting in the boardroom, if you will. We see him signing a deal. The other men are cheering like they got one over on him. But then Crown says, how are you going to explain to your shareholders? You just paid me $30 million more than other firms were offering. Basically, we're learning that he is a ruthless, masterful, massively successful businessman in mergers and acquisitions. There are men inside the horse. They climb out with breathing tanks after sawing their way out of the horse, which was left in a random basement room. They cut through the wall and are somehow in this air conditioning room, and they basically take out the AC. Then they make their way into the employee locker room, put on employee outfits, and exit into the museum. acting like they belong. Crown then, at the end of his workday, after checking his watch a few times, returns to the Met with a briefcase. That's important. He is told the room he wants to enter is closed for cleaning by these fake museum employees. And he sets down his briefcase, checks his watch, and then walks away without picking his briefcase up. He goes back to the guy he spoke with earlier who works at the museum and says, they got that place closed for cleaning. I can't look at my haystacks. And the guy's like, I'll go check it out. He goes over there and is about to let it slide when he sees the helicopter above. Actually, he sees the shadow of the helicopter blades and then looks up and sees the helicopter. And he realizes they're about to be heisted. So he pulls the alarm and they start tasing and arresting the bad guys who don't actually work there. The alarm triggers gates that come down. One gate is blocked by Thomas Crown's briefcase. He slides under the gate, pulls the $100 million Monet that he previously acted like he didn't care about off the wall, pulls his first briefcase out from under the bench that he'd sat at earlier, pops the painting inside. And I'm not really sure here, but I think we're using movie magic because he would have to basically bend this painting in two, which I don't think is possible.
Yeah, it's not.
It's weird. I thought, yeah, he had some sort of thing that like broke the frame and then bent it in two or whatever. But when he takes it out later, it's complete and whole. I was flummoxed.
It's a choice they made to just not deal with the physics of that situation.
It's even in the trivia that talks about McTiernan knew that this briefcase wouldn't work. And so they basically puts the painting in and then cuts away before he closes it.
He waltzes out of the building after that. Somehow no one sees him crawl back out under the gate, even though there's a mass of people walking through that hallway. But again, whatever, movie magic. At home, we see his amazing lifestyle, and he pulls the painting out of the briefcase, puts it up in a secret nook he has in his study, and admires it over a glass of wine and says, oh yeah. Back at the Met, we meet the two lead detectives on the case, Dennis Leary's McCann and Frankie Faison's Peretti. I actually really enjoy the interplay between these two guys. And it's a subdued Dennis Leary, which is always fun because a lot of people cast Dennis Leary to be over the top Dennis Leary. Yeah. He has one of my favorite line readings in this whole movie, but we'll get to that. They're talking through the events of the robbery when Rene Russo's Catherine Banning inserts herself into the discourse, explaining that she works for the people who have insured this painting. We get a brief scene of Crown being stubborn, gambling on a golf course, and the scene seems designed only to teach us that Pierce Brosnan looks awkward as hell swinging a golf club. While checking the cameras, the police discover the briefcase under the bench before the robbery at a lineup that has the actual culprits who have been apprehended. Crown himself serves as a witness and IDs one of the men. It's clear, though, at this moment that Banning has some kind of a hunch about Crown. Banning convinces the cops to let her interrogate one of the robbery suspects in German, mind you. And I like the choice here. Again, McTiernan does a lot of cool stuff with language. I like the choice here not to tell us what they're saying. We don't get any subtitles here. All we need to know is conveyed through the body language and the actions. And she gets out of him that it was a prearranged job. They don't know who had hired them. While guzzling from an obviously empty Pepsi One can, Banning explains that the mastermind of the robbery will not sell the painting because he loves it too much. She searches the computer for people recently bidding on Monet works and finds Thomas Crown's name. And now her hunch has a little more teeth. She starts watching him. First, at a catamaran race, that should put off any sane person from catamaran racing forever. Crown also donates one of his own collected paintings, a Pissarro, to the Met to put in the Monet spot until the Monet is returned because he's a philanthropist. He loves art. At the reception for that, Banning introduces herself to Crown and basically flat out states she thinks he took the Monet. His response is to ask her out to dinner, and she accepts. McCann, this is Dennis Leary, somehow gets some kind of a warrant to search Crown's home, but then they're apparently turned away because Crown's lawyer is there.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
The movie doesn't truly explain what's going on there because he does say this is a warrant, but then they leave all frustrated right away. And they haven't been able to search the home.
Money can buy genius lawyers who can work their way around a warrant. That's what we're supposed to believe, I think,
by in the that way, moment. Does Ben Gazzara say one word in this movie?
That's the lawyer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he says one word in that scene.
Yeah.
So no. They leave frustrated, but on their date, Banning steals his keys and a copy of his keys made. Now, I saw in the trivia that this key is a special kind of key. I didn't know this before yesterday. And apparently, it's not possible to copy that key the way the movie suggests. It has a special kind of deep groove that is uncopyable. But again, movie magic. They copy the key. At dinner, Banning and Crown take turns proving how much they know about each other. The next day, when the house is empty, Banning and her team break in to search for clues. Banning is very smart. She guesses that there's a secret compartment and then guesses that there is a button on the desk to open it. And she finds the missing Monet. Dun, dun, dun. She brings it into the police station with lots of fanfare, only to have the expert determine it's a ghost. It is a fake painted on top of dogs playing poker. This pisses her off immensely, and she immediately goes to a ball that Crown is at. Crown is dancing with a blonde girl, but she cuts in and confronts him about the fake Monet. Through the power of sexy dancing, Banning and Crown become less angry at each other and much more horny. He asks her if she wants to dance or if she wants to dance, and she kisses him. We then cut to an extended scene full of uncomfortable-looking sex on various hard surfaces in Crown's house.
The worst.
I was just like, how is this happening?
In the morning, Paul, his butler, brings breakfast, which includes the gross, mysterious green beverage that Banning likes to drink. This is just further proof that Crown can find out anything he wants to know about anyone and is prepared for all contingencies. Their next date is a glider ride in the sky, which should put off any sane person from glider riding forever. The glider lands four states from the car, she says. So he calls a private jet. And I love how the movie just makes that magic. Like, in reality, he called a private jet and they sat around twiddling their thumbs for like 4 hours. But anyway, the jet shows up. And then instead of taking them back to NYC, it takes them to Martinique. While they're deplaning, one of the items taken off the plane is a crate about the size of the stolen Monet, and she notices it. Later at his mountaintop villa of awesomeness, he asks her if she wants to see what's in the crate. She says no. Then later on, near the end of dinner, he asks her again, and she says no. And eventually she gets up and puts the painting on the fire. And Crown doesn't react at all. She finally breaks and asks, what is it? And he says it was a nice little Renoir. The next morning, she wakes up and hears Crown talking to strangers on the balcony and decides to go for a topless sunbathe. Later, she tells him that she thought they were bankers and that he's getting ready to run. He suggests bribing her. And then they have sex all night long, but at least this time they use the bed.
Yes.
When Banning returns to the police back in New York City, they show her photos of Crown with the blonde from the ball. And Banning is visibly shaken and jealous. She gives McCann photos of the borders of the stolen Monet, which she says a forger would not have access to what was on the borders unless they were in the presence of the original painting. The implication is check these against that fake Monet on top of dogs playing poker. And if they match, then the real one was in the same room as the fake one. At dinner, Crown gives her a seriously expensive necklace, but she's distracted. He can tell, and in the car, he just brings up Anna, who was the girl in the photos. But because this is a movie, they don't hash out the truth like adults, and she gets out of the car and tries to storm off. He follows after her and says he needed to see if she would get jealous so he could find out if her feelings were real, and claims this is the only way he could have done that, which is an outright lie, but it's a movie, and he's a movie character, so there you go. Then he says, what if we ran to get together away as fugitives? The borders on the fake Monet match perfectly, so the cops go and question the two most likely forgers because, as Banning explains, it's not a very large community. Both of the most likely suspected forgers blame it on the other one. One of them is in prison and says, how do you think I would do this? The paints just get delivered here by UPS and the guards just stand there while I'm in the presence of the original Monet. But he does look at the painting and seem to kind of recognize something. And Banning notices it, but he doesn't say anything more. So Banning goes to Crown's house, but finds Anna there again and assumes it's a mistress. Because again, we don't talk about things like adults in movies. We make assumptions, huge ones. Crown says, well, listen, I'm going to trust you. Tomorrow, I'm going to put that Monet back on the wall in the museum right where I took it from. And then you can meet me at the Wall Street helipad at 4 o'clock and we'll leave the country together. Or you can have the cops waiting for me at the museum. It's up to you. She chooses option B, which honestly is probably the right move if you think he's sleeping with this blonde. You don't have any proof of that. You're going to find out later he's not. But if that's your frame of mind, you know, he's done something horribly illegal. You have a responsibility to your employers. This is probably the right move. But of course, Crown knew that she would do that because, again, he is one step ahead of everybody. And he's cooked up a scheme involving a ton of doubles of himself and basically a shell game involving humans and bowler hats and briefcases. Before it kicks off, Banning learns that Anna is the forger's daughter and the forger of the fake Monet. And she realizes that she shouldn't have turned him in, but it's too late. As the antics continue on the security monitors and hilarity ensues, Banning finally gives in and just starts laughing at the absurdity of everything. Crown then throws smoke bombs into the impressionist room and pulls the fire alarm, and we see protective metal walls fold out to cover up all the paintings, except the one that Crown had donated due to pencils jammed in the grooves. And the sprinklers turn on to put out the fire and wash away the painting that Crown had donated to reveal that the original stolen Monet is underneath it, right in the spot it had been stolen from. When the walls roll back, we see that another painting has gone missing. It is the one Banning had said earlier in the film she liked the best in the room, and he had playfully offered to get it for her. And with that, Banning races to the heliport. But instead of Crown, she finds a man in a bowler hat with a case. He gives it to her, and it's the painting. Dejected, thinking that she's been left behind, she goes to the airport by herself. She asks the gate worker to return what's in the case to the police and boards the plane. And then, as she takes off from New York City, she finally starts letting herself feel the emotions, and she starts to cry. A hand reaches up from behind her and offers her a handkerchief. She turns around, and of course, it's Crown, and she angry kisses him and then says, "You pull another stunt like that, I'll break both your arms." Mm-hmm. And then we go to credits. That is the Thomas Crown Affair, 1999. How did you guys feel about it this time through?
First off, let's shout out Mark Margolis, who was playing the forger in that scene. Tio Salamanca himself was in that.
Nice.
People are bringing up the part about the ending. Like, how did he steal that painting? You know, one thing about stealing the painting is that nobody cares about that painting. So it's it might be a thing where he just ripped it off the wall and nobody gave a shit because the haystacks don't matter, or the whatever, the Rene Russo Steelbooks, one, yeah. The one that she wanted, doesn't matter. I was wondering if we think Thomas Crown is the kind of person who would go to therapy. I'm not questioning him going to therapy, but is he the kind of guy that just kind of does that? And is that the only way they got Faye Dunaway in this picture? Is that what they're basically saying?
It's a fair question. I would be surprised if he met her and was going to therapy trying to sleep with her.
It's very possible.
I think they use the therapy to create a possibility that Thomas Crown is a different kind of person than every single action he makes the entirety of the rest of the movie indicates that he is. They use it to soften him, in my opinion. So, yeah.
Okay. I was basically just adding this to the large, well, I guess, I don't know if it's large, but there's, you know, in 1999, we had Sopranos came out and Analyze This came out. And that was a whole big thing. Like, oh, look at that, gangsters going to therapy. Isn't that weird and quirky? It's funny to me. I think we're supposed to root for Thomas Crown, but he's kind of a dick.
He's the worst.
The movie plainly shows he's a true dick of a businessman, and it's really shown through the people he has conducting business with him. They're ruthless people. And I think it's an interesting aspect that they portray him negatively. He's not a good guy, but you're still going to root for him because he's Pierce Brosnan. He's James Bond at this point.
Yep.
So it was kind of an interesting thing to see that.
It's one of my first thoughts is like he is a gaslighter. He is a narcissist. He is all the things you associate with the rich person who just toys with people, you know, like because they have the money to do so. So yeah, I noticed that as well.
But you guys are forgetting how sexy he is.
Oh, that's right.
I am not forgetting how sexy he is. I'm not forgetting how sexy everybody in this movie is.
Mm-hmm, that's very true. The opening high scene's very McTiernan. We can see his influence on that. It plays a lot like the Federal Reserve heist and Die Hard with a Vengeance. Including a guy who doesn't speak English, and we are told will never speak English. They do that in Die Hard with a Vengeance as well. McTiernan always seems to have to put something. You mentioned it lightly there, Jeremy, but he always seems to do something with languages in his movies. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's sort of a trademark of his. I talked about the painting not fitting the briefcase. By the way, it seemed like I was just sinning this movie when I was noting it at first. And someone in the chat brought this up too, about him getting almost run over by the garbage truck at the beginning. There is a car sitting right there in front. What is this guy speeding towards anyway? And then after the exchange, and he holds up his briefcase and everything, dude goes zooming off. There's no way where to zoom off. I didn't understand when they were looking at the video and they saw that the briefcase was the third leg on the bench, why they didn't go back further to show who put the briefcase under the bench.
Yep.
And I rewound this a couple of times to see if there was a reason for it. And no, the only reasons why they don't want to watch certain things in the future is because it's too hot and the sensors don't pick up the people versus the walls or whatever. But anything before that, like, why wouldn't they want to know who put that underneath? That could just solve the case right there to me. I guess there would be no movie if that happened. So the relationship between Crown and his so-called daughter is a little bit more romantic than it should be.
I agree.
I know that they're trying to make it seem like, you know, that's a young lover that he's taken or whatever, but there's a point where she's sitting on his bed in like lingerie, like not lingerie, but like very, like not like, you know, it just seems like she's been in his bed for a while and all that. You saying something, Aaron?
No. I was just curious. Did you say his? It's not his daughter. It's the forger. It's the forger's daughter.
No, and he's the guardian. He's the guardian.
He became her guardian.
Oh, I see. He's her guardian. Okay. So all right. Yeah.
It's basically
they his have daughter. A father-daughter relationship, is what. Yes. Okay. That's all I need clarified. Yeah.
I know that it's supposed to be to make Rene Russo all jealous and everything, but I'm shocked that it's this close. They're dancing close together. She's sitting in his bed and all this stuff. I know that these are all circumstantial things, but that stuff that you'd feel like a daughter figure wouldn't be doing at all. I'm also surprised these detectives didn't find this earlier. Like, that was something they easily found, was that he was the guardian of this girl or whatever. Again, maybe there's not a movie.
I think he even says right under our noses or something like that. Yeah. He says something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah. And we talked about that sex that Russo and Brosnan have, the fucking stairs, man, on books. The love fest between her and Brosnan bring this movie down for me. Now, I like this movie, and I like it better than the 1968 version. I like it a lot better than the 1968 version. But that romantic thing going back and forth, it just weighs it down. We have all this fun stuff with the art and the stealing and the, you know, and the heist and everything. And it's like now you got this big, long romantic subplot that really kind of weighs it down, I think. I love the fact that they play Center Man by Nina Simone during that final heist, just because we are a sins family here and we point out sins.
It's also drives the action, that piece of music. Perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. And then final note about the movie before I get into a couple of the trivia moments, but I love how at the end of it, Rene Russo is like, "Did you set this up?" and jumps over the seat, tackles Pierce Brosnan, and they're like making out. And the flight attendant's like, the first thing she can come up with is the seatbelt thing is on. That's like the last thing that I would be worried about is the seatbelt. And then she's like, Okay, they're lovers. Okay, that's fine. They can fuck here. That doesn't matter.
Oh, you're going to kiss? Well, then forget the seatbelts.
Exactly. Don't worry about it. But I saw a couple of things in the trivia that I thought was fun. This is in the IMDb trivia. In the scene where Thomas Crown is dancing at the party, his tie is untied on his tux and the top button's unbuttoned. This is because at the time, Pierce Brosnan was under contract to play James Bond, and a rumored stipulation of that contract was that he could not wear a tuxedo in any non-James Bond movies. Additionally, note the tie in his in this film is white, and James Bond, he's usually wearing a black or dark bow tie. Just a rumor, but I think that's kind of fun. And then the idea of unusual heat in a museum rendering thermal cameras useless came from John McTiernan's Predator. In that movie, McTiernan thermal cameras began to fail when the jungle temperature broke 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's, I thought that was a kind of
awesome, cool There's thing. So many cool things in the trivia for this. Is one of the coolest trivia read throughs that I've had for this show. Like the green muscle car that he drives on Martinique. That's actually James McTiernan's car. When they land the glider, there's a tractor and a farmer behind them. That's actually McTiernan's tractor. Like, he owns that tractor. And I love the idea that they're making a movie. Hey, we need a tractor. There's probably one within a 5-mile radius. No, hang on. I've got one in my barn. Five states away. I'm going to have it trucked here. We're gonna save money. I don't know. I don't even know if that saves money. But yeah, there's a lot of cool trivia like that.
Yep.
It is a testament to the talent of McTiernan that I come out of this movie having a good time. because there's a lot of nonsense in this movie. I will explain. There are some foundational things that really get under my skin with movies like this. One of them is the portrayal of the Rene Russo character. I have a real problem with that character. It is portrayed in this way that the Banning is always one step behind. If Banning is supposed to be a cat and mouse person with him, the movie does not do a good job of elevating her to his level. He has her at every step of the way. He toys with her. He gaslights her. When she does the keys, we're supposed to believe she has one up on him. She does not. He knows exactly what's going on. He's replaced the painting with the dogs, you know, in poker behind it. He was so far ahead of her that he had time to commission dogs in poker covered by the Monet. Like, that's how far ahead he is of her.
And by the way, I don't think that is the dogs playing poker famous one. There's a series of them. And I can't remember what this one is called, but it's not the famous.
I think it's also impressive that he put that painting back within 2 days. So his forger daughter, she perfectly copied a Monet in 48 hours. No, less than that. He had to frame it. Like, I just think that's wild.
Yeah.
Yep.
She early on says, "Do you think I'm the kind of woman that would sleep with a man that I'm investigating?" And I'm going, "I hope not. That seems like a terrible, you know, being terrible at your job." But she is that kind of woman. And she even says something later where it's like, "I hate being, what's the word she used? I should have written it down.
A foregone conclusion.
I hate being a foregone conclusion." Like, the movie takes steps to diminish her, like, through this entire movie, because it is playing into the idea of this very suave man who will woo her and, you know, have her by the end. Like, she is the painting to him. She is the setup. He is going to woo her and have her by the end. It does not feel to me to be a back and forth kind of relationship. It feels to me to be kind of that classic idea of, this is the man's role in the relationship, this is the woman's. The man woos, chases, you know, and the woman is subdued. And that's, you know, what the movie does. That in itself is just, you know, whatever, if that's the story. But the movie wants it to be different than that. Like, the movie wants her to be his equal. It's like how it's setting it up. And it never felt that way to me.
The only scene I think tries to do that, and I'm not going to say it succeeds, is when she first introduces herself to him. He's clearly caught off guard. But that's it. You're absolutely right in that. It does not put them on equal footing.
He even uses her petty jealousy against her at one point. You know, I think we've talked about this too. Like, she is immediately jealous like super jealous. And so jealous, she gives up something she was hiding because maybe she had feelings for him, but now she's jealous, so she's going to give it up. Like, it's a really interesting portrayal.
It's perhaps because I've seen so many Ocean's movies at this point that I expected him to be like, well, I knew when I stole this painting that this group had it insured and they'd send you out, and I've done all my homework on you and I know everything about you and I knew all this was going to happen. I was expecting all of that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Also, let me ask you this.
Sure.
Wouldn't forgers know about the borders thing?
You would think
so. Why would you forge the borders if you know that there's a way for to verify that you've been in the presence of the actual painting? Through the, like, if I'm a forger, I'm never putting the borders on, then you're never going to think I've been in the presence of
exactly.
a regular
player. Exactly.
The other things, and Chris, you mentioned a lot of the sins type stuff, and there's a lot. I mean, we would destroy this movie if we send this. There's so much in those.
I had to stop myself a couple times.
There is so much there, so I won't go into detail on that. The only other thing I will mention on this level is the Dennis Leary character, who, by the way, I love. I think it might be my favorite character in the movie. There's something so weird about how he changes his tune at the end. And I've been trying to figure it out. Like, the whole time he's given her grief about, you know, breaking the law and, you know, doing these things. And at the end, he's like, what do I care about what rich people do? I'm just like, wait, when did you shift? The movie didn't show me this big shift in your heart. Like, what moment did you have that changed your, you know, your whole tune on this thing? Yeah, that was interesting to me too.
By the way,
go ahead.
Jeremy talking about Dennis Leary being usually used as this over the top guy. This movie behind me is whatever. Yes. If I can point to it correctly, I can't. is a case in point of that. Going off the rails. Anyway,
I love after she gets the painting that she thinks is the real Monet and brings it into the police station. This is one of my favorite line readings in the whole movie. Dennis Leary walks over to her and he goes, "So, are the laws of the United States completely unknown to you?" It's a line that I think only he could deliver that perfectly.
I've got a question about Dennis Leary, though. In the past, when we're not super internet obsessed, would Dennis Leary have a career? Because he was long accused of joke thievery. Bill Hicks. Bill Hicks before he died, actually.
So I think he did that firefighter show on FX, right? Rescue Me, is that what it was called? I think that did a lot to rehab whatever rough edges he had on his image. And then I don't want to talk out of my ass, but I feel like he has done some charitable cause related things with regard to that show and firefighters and first responders. Mm-hmm. I could be talking out of my ass. I'll do some research here in a second. But that show, I remember, is where he sort of started becoming an actor in terms of how people saw him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just think it's interesting because Dennis Leary is somebody that I like in movies, basically. I mean, for the most part. It's just that, like a lot of other people, a lot of other stand-up comedians, he was accused of joke thievery. So, are we saying this guy, it's okay for this guy? I don't know. This is something that every time I see him, I'm like, God, I really like him in this movie, but I always think about that Bill
Hicks. I didn't know that stuff.
He also has a terrible quote in a book that he wrote about autism.
Oh,
I'm going to read you this quote because I think it's worth it to put this guy in context because he published this. This is not like an interview off the cuff.
Sure.
There is a huge boom in autism right now because inattentive mothers and competitive dads want an explanation for why their dumbass kids can't compete academically. So they throw money into the happy laps of shrinks to get a diagnosis back that will help explain away the deficiencies of their junior morons.
Jesus Christ.
That was 2008.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that is shameful.
I didn't mean to bring this down about the final heist.
Right.
I'm just saying once we take a few steps down that path, I think it's worth at least exposing that.
Sure.
I went looking for the generous charitable stuff and found this first. But he doesn't have a firefighters foundation that he started. basically after 1999 when firefighters in his hometown were killed in a warehouse fire. So like all humans, there is good and bad. Both inside this man. So.
Yeah. Yes. No, I think that's it's totally fair. I did want to say one more kind of nitpicky, although I think it's a big one for me. Can someone explain to me in that final heist why in a situation where they have a system designed to protect these paintings from water, he's like, I'll do watercolors on top of this expensive painting and then drench it in water to wash them off as if that's not going to damage the painting in any way.
At all.
I could not figure out, like, I mean, it literally is just so we can have that reveal. It's literally just so that they'd be, oh, cool. It was there the whole time. You know, this is the way we're going to do it. It is a great reveal.
He's sexy, Aaron.
He's totally sexy. And I will tell you, I do want to finish with the things I love about this movie. And again, I mentioned McTiernan. He is so good at understanding what the audience needs to see and wants to see when doing action or tension. He understands what perspective to put you in to engage you and to tell you the story of what's going on. That is very evident in the bookend heists that start the movie and end the movie. They are both phenomenal filmmaking. Like it's like film school worthy. Like, study these scenes and how he's using this shot selection to draw you to that room to help you understand the geometry of what's going on. There's a reason he does action so well. He really understands the visual aspects of it. And I love the Anna twist. I think the Anna twist is a great story twist. The twist that she is the forger's daughter and that, you know, she wasn't somebody he was in love with, that, you know, she is in many ways truly somebody that has been helping him. I think it's set up really well and paid off pretty well.
They look like they're in love the whole movie. So,
right,
you
know, aside from really well.
I don't think she ever speaks. I'm not sure she had a line of dialogue the whole film, because think they decided that even her speaking would probably kill her misconception of what's going on.
Well, and it uses our own stereotypes, prejudice against us with, you know, a woman who looks like a model is, you know, just a beautiful woman that's arm candy. That's all they're there for. And it uses that against us to go, no, she's a, you know, an absolute excellent forger.
And we see those at the beginning where it's like Nikki Tyler and Cindy Crawford and all these other models who he's got signed pictures of in his mantle.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Are we ready for the super secret double feature?
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
I think we better be.
All right.
I didn't prep one. It's not my responsibility.
I'm gonna go very, very obscure on this one. Okay. Jeremy loves his heist movie. So every time I watch a heist movie, I'm like, oh, here's another heist movie. This kind of and I try to stay away from the other heist movies. But there is a movie from 1973 that I do not believe was released until 1976 by Orson Welles called F for Fake. Where he is talking about art forgers, and the movie is done in such a wild way. Like the whole thing just seems like the whole thing is like Orson Welles right off the bat tells you he's a liar, he's a forger. He says this guy is a famous forger. The guy who wrote the biography about him is a forger. Everybody's forging everything, I don't know. It's one of those movies that some people are not going to be able to get through the first 10 minutes, but if you can, it's a really fascinating, like it's a documentary, but not told in a documentary way at all. It's told in a very like a magician is telling a story the whole time. And, Jeremy, I don't know if this is a movie that seems right up your alley or not. I think after the first 5 or 10 minutes, you're going to be like, what the fuck is going on in this thing? But it is about art forgeries. And it's talking about how, you know, forgeries brought the rise of experts, and experts are the ones that we rely on to say something is fake or real or not. And a lot of times they can't tell what's real or fake. So do we really rely on the experts? That type of thing. It's a lot of like stuff like that going on. So
there's there's a great line in American Hustle where Christian Bale, they're in an art museum and he points at a painting and he says, "You see that painting? That's a fake." And the guy he's talking to is like, "I think it's Bradley Cooper." He's like, "Get out of here. That's not a fake. Like, it's like a $60 million painting." And he's like, "No, it's fake." Now, let me ask you this. Who's the real talent? The original painter or the forger who paints the thing that you can't tell the difference with? I thought that was just
There. Exactly.
My super secret double feature, man, the obvious one for me, and it became a little too obvious to even use, but the obvious one for me was Out of Sight. Came out the year before, and it has that cat and mouse, you know, sexy kind of thing. In fact, I think a lot of the things that I don't like about Thomas Crown Affair are in direct opposite to what I love about Out of Sight. So that might be part of my, you know, thinking on that. I love the way the J-Lo character is portrayed and the decisions that she makes and those kind of things. But I eventually went with Hitchcock, as I am wont to do, and decided to go with To Catch a Thief. Cary Grant and Grace Kelly, this isn't one of the greater Hitchcocks for, you know, for a reason. I think it's...
You take that back.
I should say it isn't considered by many to be one of the greater Hitchcocks. I do love it, and I think Cary Grant and Grace Kelly are absolute smoke on screen. They're so good. And in this case, we're dealing with the thing that Hitchcock loves, which is an innocent man who has been accused of something, and in this case it is art thievery, so it works well with that. And so it involves them trying to figure this out while falling in love. So it worked for me as a good double feature. So yeah, I really enjoy To Catch a Thief.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know Out of Sight was your sort of second choice, but it's interesting in the original Thomas Crown Affair, there's a scene that I thought was exactly like Out of Sight's like sex scene where they're going back and forth. They're talking at the restaurant and then they come back and they show them stripping clothes down and all that.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in the original Thomas Crown Affair, they're playing chess and there's a lot of just like very sexy getting closer and closer. Yeah. Of course, Faye Dunaway like feels a bishop up. That's real subtle. but like everything beyond that is like really sexy. Just the way how they get closer, her looks at him, his looks at her, all that are really, really cool. But anyway, all right. Now for next week's homework, we are continuing the comedies through the decades. We'll go to the 2010s, and this time we will be watching The Death of Stalin. Get Armando Iannucci in on the game, on the comedy game here. This movie is very funny, and I cannot wait to revisit it.
Me too.
I was looking through a lot of the 2010s, and this one just is the one that stood out as needs to be on Wreckatopia. So
The Google tells me this is on Pluto TV, the Roku channel, and Plex, and Hulu, and AMC Plus, lots of places.
All right. Well, we talked enough Thomas Crown Affair that's a whole show.
That's a whole show.
Once again, thanks, chat, for coming out and watching us talk about movies today. I guess that's going to be it. We'll see you next time. See you.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, guys. Bye.
Be a part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
What's up, foes?
What's up?
You're not my foes. You're my friends. I saw an article this morning that Godzilla Minus One is going to be streaming in early May on Amazon Prime, only in Japan. Hundreds of beavers. That was my Dracula voice. Hundreds of beavers.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Okay, so my smart car gives me a number of alerts, almost all of them on my screen. Like every time it senses the temperature drop to 39 degrees, and this is my second car that does this, it says, be careful, there may be ice.
Right? Yeah.
Thank you, car. When I'm low on gas, it brings up a thing on my thing that says, you're low on gas. Would you like me to find you a gas station? And I'm like, no, thank you, car. I know where they are. But there's one alert it gives me that is a computerized female voice.
Okay.
And it is the alert when I'm approaching a stoplight that has a camera to take your picture if you run the stoplight.
Okay.
And then it mails you a ticket. I could do a whole aside here about how those aren't technically, you don't even have to pay those because it's not issued by the actual police department. But anyway, for some reason, the makers of my car said we need to warn humans driving that they are about to approach an intersection that has a traffic camera.
Okay.
And instead of on screen, like every other alert, this needs to be a voice. And this is a lot of setup, but this has been really bothering me. When I get about what looks to me a handful of blocks away from that light, that's when the voice comes on. And she'll say, in 0.2 miles, traffic light camera ahead. Except every now and then, for reasons I cannot fathom, instead of 0.2 miles, she says, in a quarter mile, traffic light camera ahead. And she says it at the exact same point in the road. So she's not, and yes, I'm making her an entity. She's not like measuring the distance and giving me a quarter mile or 0.2 miles based on those distances.
Right.
She's just saying one of those two phrases. Why does she have metric and fractions? Like, is there a software wire that's crossed here or am I insane? There's no reason that she should go back and forth between those two different measurements, right?
I mean, unless it's programmed that way so that it feels a little more, you know, extemporaneous, you know, like that it's programmed so you're not hearing the exact same thing every time.
Well, then why doesn't she say in 3/4 of a mile? It's always 0.2 or a quarter mile. That's it. Here's my theory. For the American customers, she's supposed to say in a quarter mile. For the Canadian customers, she's supposed to say in 0.2 miles. No, that would be kilometers. Shit. My theory's down the drain. I have no idea why she's doing this. And I, at first I thought, and my wife had this brilliant idea, maybe it has to do with how fast you're going. And if you're going faster, she says quarter mile to give you slightly more time to react than 0.2 miles. But I've tested that. I've gone 35, I've gone 65, and it's not about what speed I'm going. So that is the greatest mystery in my life.
It might be just when it is alerted to your distance. Like maybe the time it takes to ping back how far away you are.
I see.
And it gets to a certain point and it's like, oh, that's 0.2. No, that's a quarter. That's the only thing I can think.
It could be because there's certainly at least some measure of time between the satellite and the car.
It's kind of like, you know, you watch a sporting event on cable, and if you watch it streaming, there's a difference between the two things, and it may not be the best analogy. I think radio is the best analogy because radio gets way off. If you ever go to like a Sirius XM and listen to a baseball team, it's like a minute away from the actual action, whereas the MLB app, it's like faster than what's on TV. I'll never understand that, but like, but I get the sense that there's a lot of like, just, it's got to communicate. It's got to hit a certain thing. And what it's doing is it's constantly feeding out to a satellite and the satellite's coming back with its information. And whenever that happens, that's when you get either the 0.2 or the quarter.
That's a good theory. I also would like to know why that is the single event that warrants a voice warning. Why can't the voice say, hey, you're out of gas. Would you like me to find you? Why can't she speak then? Mm-hmm. In 20 miles, you'll be out of gas. Let me know.
Sounds like you need to set up an interview with the software programmer for this car and really get down to the brass tacks.
To get the actual answer, that may be what I have to do. I may have to actually make a documentary out of this. Like,
maybe sounds good. You mentioned the, you know, like watching baseball on two different devices, right? And like how sometimes one device will spoil the other one kind of thing. So I very rarely go to games, but I was at a Tigers game one time recently, and I'm watching the score on my phone, and I literally had the thought, oh, I better quit watching my phone in case it spoils.
While you're at the live
while
event.
I'm watching the event, like my phone knows the future somehow.
That might be a fun prank to go to a game and act like you're listening to the broadcast and then stand up and start cheering before anything's actually happened.
I think, have I ever told you guys, maybe on this very thing, when I was watching the Super Bowl with the Seahawks and the Patriots, and there were people upstairs at the place that I was at, and I was downstairs. The pass that Russell Wilson threw that got intercepted, we're all sitting there, and we just hear, Oh, no! Why didn't they run Lynch? You know, that type of thing. And then, so we're all just, all the people who are downstairs are just looking around and kind of going, well, guess we know what's going to happen here.
Oh, no. I still remember, I don't watch it much anymore, but the Deadliest Catch season that followed that Super Bowl, there was a whole episode where they were all the captains and crew were paying attention to the Super Bowl, and they're out there on the Bering Sea going, why didn't they run Lynch?
I will just say one thing about this movie. I somehow missed the scene where Rene Russo was curvaceously working her way through lasers. I thought that was in this movie somewhere, but I totally missed it. So
yes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.